Today I'm joined once again by my friend Jeremy Carl. Jeremy is a senior fellow at the Claremont Institute. He also served as the Deputy Assistant Secretary for the Interior under President Trump, and he also was a research fellow at the Hoover Institution. Among these accolades, he also counts the title of a published writer, and his latest book is The Unprotected Class, How Anti-White Racism is Tearing America Apart. Welcome back, Jeremy.
It's a pleasure to be on, Alex.
I'm glad you're back on. We have probably one of the more vivid histories together. We've met each other a few times in reality, which is a rare case here on the show. And you're not only kind of a man of politics, obviously, you've been in politics for a long time, you've been in D.C., and you've been, you know, at the Hoover Institution, you've been marinating all this type of stuff, but you also are, I feel like, something of a super connector. You're always someone kind of at the nodes of introducing people to other people, and I always appreciate this stuff because this is a talent that I lack. This is not very, something I'm not very good at, but you're like always kind of keeping in mind who would need to speak to whom. And I think, yeah, this is something that, you know, I really appreciate about you. Beside the fact that you're also a father of five, and yeah, I mean, you're doing it all and living in Montana and having, you know, the trad life, I guess, relatively.
Yeah.
Yeah, so
there are no trad wife videos that my wife is making, but other than
I don't know if she actually has time. I feel like you need to, you know, be funded by billionaires to actually, you know, have the staff to produce the high grade content that trad wifery.
I am not the CEO of JetBlue, and this is not Ballerina Farm, which was a wonderful thing that I found out only from listening to your podcast. I did not.
Yeah.
As a heterosexual man, I was not aware that it existed before then.
It's really nice. And it's not heterosexual coded. Even though the lady is really beautiful, it's very much, you know, it's all spit up and a lot of babies being covering the erogenous zones. So there's not much for the heterosexual crowd. I wanted to maybe start with the question of, did you get any flack for including the term anti-white in your title, in the title of your book? Because this is, you know, this is not Straussian, I think,
yeah,
in terms of. So, tell me a little bit about how this title was received.
Yeah, well, there is a little Straussianism in the book, but I'll let the reader discover that. But you're absolutely right. I mean, yeah, I'm glad you asked that, because in many ways, kind of saying the word anti-white was foundational to what I wanted to do, because there are people who talk about wokeness or CRT, and there's a lot of fan dancing. And look, I get it. I totally get it. And this is why you ask the question ultimately, right? Because when you are a mainstream person who's been in mainstream politics with certain rules and procedures and mores, this is a taboo violation. And Heather McDonald, in her very nice kind of review that she gave me, blurb for the book, I mean, mentions this quite overtly, as well as a couple other of my reviewers. So I wanted to be very explicit, and I felt like to tell an honest story with the book, I really at the same time needed to put anti-whiteness front and center. And so it is in the subtitle. I actually originally had the title that was even a little bit more risque, It's Okay to Be White. But you're laughing, and those of us who listen to the Subversive podcast will appreciate the many layers that title has. And in fact, I got that by the publishers themselves, and then the salespeople kind of came in and said, you know, we're never going to be able to sell that to Costco, which in and of itself to me was a very revealing comment, because the whole point of that meme that exists is that there really shouldn't be anything objectionable to this. It's okay to be Black. It's okay to be Hispanic. It's okay to be Asian. It's okay to be white, right? But of course, in our cultural context, this is a very transgressive sort of thing to say. And so I was trying to play around with that. So we kind of went for this more scholarly sounding title, The Unprotected Class, which is the main title. And that's a phrase that comes out of civil rights law and protected classes, for those familiar with that sort of law in the US. But then I felt really strongly we needed to put anti-whiteness directly in that title. And so that was very, very conscious. And that getting that somewhere in the title was a non-negotiable item for me.
And how did the publisher react to this? Because you just went straight to Regnery, which is a fairly mainstream publisher, obviously conservative, but still they publish pretty much the big name conservatives. Were they kind of hesitant? Were they embracing this new wind of change? What was the reaction?
Well, I did go to Regnery for a reason, and I didn't go to the big five New York publishers because I really wanted to go with a publisher that I felt like would not try to mess with the content and would stick with me. And I didn't know. I didn't know whether they'd accept it or not. I had never dealt with them previously. I had some good references to Regnery from people who I think they trusted. And I had the sort of background with my little fancy degrees and things like that and time in very mainstream politics that I think maybe made some of what I was doing a little more comprehensible and comfortable for them, because it was like, okay, you know, this guy worked for the former Secretary of State for 10 years. He was at the Hoover Institution. He's not just going to go write some screed. And if anything, I mean, I think the book really is, the thesis itself is provocative enough that there was no need to do a bunch of rhetorical flourishes or to go beyond what the data said. I just really try to lay out a very responsible but firm case for my thesis. And I think that also probably helped. And yeah, you have to work up a book proposal for these people. And they liked what they saw, and they were a pleasure to work with.
Yeah, and there is a lot of meat on these bones here. You know what book this reminded me of? And I hope you don't take this as an insult, because this is one of the most important books that I've ever read. It's the Ellen Carr book, To Give Up Smoking. I don't know if you've ever...
I don't know that book at all.
It's a very famous book for smokers. It's essentially kind of almost like a neurolinguistic programming where the guy makes the car salesman's case, you know, very detailed, extremely persuasive about why smoking is this absolute terrible hazard for you. And he really goes systematically through it. And by the end of the book, you don't want to smoke. And it really works. It's called, I think, The Easy Way to Quit Smoking. If you're in the smoking world, this is probably a known thing. You probably were never...
I think this is because you're European, that this is more familiar to you, where smoking is...
This is an American book. Yeah. And obviously, your book has nothing to do with smoking. But I think the meticulousness, the persuasiveness of it, and just the sheer amount of data that you bring to the table, you know, at the end of it, it's... very hard to argue against it, especially like you said, this is fairly cold data. You haven't written like a screed. There's no shrieking in this. There's no, pearl clutching. It is, okay, look at this. This was the case in the 60s, or this was, you know, things have progressed in this direction. The trend is this. And you go through so many layers of it. So I think, you know, that's why I'm saying, don't take this the wrong way. Yeah. It's not about the smoking bit. It's about the persuasiveness and the how meticulous you were in laying this out. And it's, it's quite glaring if you look at it that way.
Well, that's great. I mean, that's what I was really trying to do. And there's an element of res ipsa loquitur here. I mean, the thing itself speaks. That was really my approach to it, is I didn't need to dress this up. I didn't need to go make some incendiary statements. If I just laid out the facts and really took this from a wide variety of different kind of areas of human endeavor. And as I mentioned in the book, it's not that everything I'm doing here is some groundbreaking new area that nobody ever looked at any element of it at all. No, for each of my kind of subject chapters, even, I'd say for a lot of them, you could even find a book about it. Now, I wouldn't necessarily maybe use the word white in the title, or it would kind of glide
Heather
over.
Heather McDonald book, I guess.
Yeah, Heather. And, you know, it's funny you mentioned Heather. I mean, and Heather was the first person I reached out to when I decided to write this book, because she's had a lot of experience in this area. And I just kind of wanted to talk with her and kind of go through it. It was sort of funny because she's so direct. And I sort of asked her about, I remember because I was driving toward Yellowstone National Park near my home. And I had to pull over like the one place I actually had a cell phone signal when she called back from New York. And we talked in a gas station parking lot for like an hour. And she was, the whole concept of that of like positioning a book was like foreign to her. You know, you just sort of write autistically, like whatever you want to write. But that was actually probably the advice that I needed. But I think what I tried to do in this book was to say, okay, I'm going to look at this endeavor from each of these different subjects. Each of these people are touching, it's the blind man and the elephant. They're touching one part of the elephant, okay, and they're describing it for you. And what I'm trying to say in this book is the elephant is actually an elephant, and that's really important. And so that was really the kind of core of my message. And there's, for any one of these subjects, people can and have go into much bigger depth, but they haven't tied it all together. And they sometimes haven't been explicit that what we're really talking about here is anti-whiteness. And so that's really what I've tried to do in the book.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so maybe we can start by going back. I mean, this has not always been the case. The U.S. was founded on a certain set of principles by pretty white people.
Yeah.
And when do you think things got rolling into this direction? I mean, what was kind of the first few steps in this direction?
It's an interesting question, and I sketch out some of that history, but I'm not sure that I have a neat answer for you. I think obviously the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was really foundational, and then things that happened after that, the kind of administrative state being accretive, and then you had the Civil Rights Act of 1991 that sort of turbocharged a lot of this. But even though I think that Richard Hanania has kind of written on somewhat similar subject recently, and I think he's a very provocative guy, very, very opposite in certain ways to my...
And Christopher Caldwell, I feel like people are forgetting about this. I mean, I love Richard Hanania, and I not always agree with him, but he's obviously a very, you know, good pundit. But Christopher Caldwell, he made this point like a few years ago.
Absolutely. And Christopher, I mean, so both of them in my second chapter where I talk about civil rights, they're kind of, particularly Christopher Caldwell, my Claremont colleague, are sort of the foundational people that I use in discussing this. So I think they're both very important. At the same time, I think we can be too reductionistic when we just look at the legal element. That was important, but there were cultural mores that predated that. And there were things that have added onto that culturally, accretively in subsequent years that I think are just as important, to the point that if you completely eliminated civil rights law right now, and I suggest some pretty fundamental reforms, a lot of this stuff is not going to go away, or at least not going to go away immediately. So I think some wholesale reform of civil rights law, which we do need, is great, but it doesn't solve the problem because it's become so ingrained in the culture. And when we get to things like when my entertainment chapter, a lot of the things in the entertainment industry are not the result of anybody's rule, but rules they've put on themselves. Or the way that white people are portrayed in commercials. And I mentioned the site, I can't remember the Twitter site, but there's an entire Twitter site that's dedicated to like how stupid white people look in every commercial and how they're kind of always the figure of fun if it's an interracial thing. That's not a result of civil rights law. That's a result of something that is much deeper culturally going on.
Yeah, I completely agree. I feel like all of this was in the water and was crystallized into the civil rights law. And then a lot of these books that point to civil rights law, I mean, to be honest, I haven't read Richard's book now recently, but I guess, you know, this seems to be the main point that he makes, the idea that the policy of disparate impact, almost like a mistake, or people didn't know how far reaching it would be and how many it would trickle into wokeness. It was baked into the purpose. I mean, MLK essentially was describing the policy of disparate impact in some of his lesser known speeches, but it was there.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, I even in my own book, in a way that I don't believe Richard did, but I could be wrong, I'd have to go back and read it, discussed very specifically when the law was made, people were basically effectively, if you follow the Senate debate, they were like, we're not doing anything like disparate impact. And then the administrative state kind of ignored that. And they kind of put in a little bit of disparate impact, and then a little bit, but mostly the case, there was a legal case called Griggs versus Duke Power that went to the Supreme Court. And disparate impact, for those of your listeners who don't know, is basically, to kind of oversimplify it, it's the notion that if you ever have kind of a disparate protected group, usually race in this case, if there's like 5% black people in a senior executive role, but 25% of the population, it could be said that there's a disparate impact of certain policies that you might be using to promote on kind of how this promotion is going on. And then you have to prove all these things that basically you have good business justification for doing it. And in fact, what happens in most cases is that they don't do it at all. And in fact, there's a member of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, a law professor who wrote a very good paper that I cite in the book called effectively like disparate impact makes everything presumptively illegal. And so you have that. And then people did realize that it was a problem. And in fact, the Supreme Court then just 18 years later, in what's Ward's Cove Packing Company versus, I believe, Antonio, effectively gutted disparate impact because they said, whoa, okay, we kind of like went beyond. We didn't realize exactly what can of worms were opening up. And they kind of changed where the burden of proof was. And then what happened was civil rights groups screamed. And the Bush administration, even though their senior civil rights appointees, one of whom has written a kind of comprehensive paper kind of explaining what was going on in the department at the time, understood exactly how bad it was going to be to go back to a disparate impact regime. But George H.W. Bush was not exactly a courageous warrior on these sorts of issues, and he just folded for the politics. And so then this was written effectively in 1991 in the Civil Rights Act into law. And so that's that type of development is very common in the kind of growth and metastasis of the civil rights regime that we're under currently.
Yeah, I think historically it's been pretty hard to roll back with something which this is a huge concession to minority groups, you know, the idea that you have this hammer, this sword of Damocles hanging over every employer. Rolling that back is tricky from multiple levels.
And it's funny you mentioned that because in my book, I even quote, although it's in a different context, Thurgood Marshall, the first African-American Supreme Court justice, I think very much describing, I mean, civil rights law, where he says the power of the sword of Damocles is not that it falls, but that it hangs. And I think that's very much the case of what civil rights law is. And in fact, some of the people who kind of try to rebut its importance say, oh, well, you know, there's only this many cases or for this many dollars, and it's not really that big a deal. But what they don't understand is that every business is changing their policies preemptively so they don't fall prey to any of this at all. And that's not as easy. I mean, people have tried to quantify it, but it's not as obvious to quantify.
Yeah, exactly. And that's kind of the legal side of it. And then every business, unfortunately, is populated with people who really believe in this stuff on the other side. You know, the marketing, HR, you know, the soft skills departments tend to be the other arm of this this belief system, and to make sure that you never get rid of it in any company. An important chapter here, not the most important, all of them are equally important, as I mentioned, is a chapter on crime. This is a subject that's been very, very popular on social media, especially with the reign of King Elon. It is now okay to speak about crime, especially about crime and criminality in different subpopulations, to put it that way. I think the interesting thing, and I think that the most red pilling, black pilling, whatever pilling aspect of kind of the disparate treatment of different populations in the U.S. and in the West in general, is this kind of feeling of anarcho-tyranny, is a feeling that, okay, you know, there are carve-outs for different enclaves, for different regions, for different peoples. And at the same time, there is this perception that it's actually the opposite, you know, the carve outs are for, you know, the dominant population, the white people, you know, they dominate everything. They get lenient treatment, and it is a bit maddening. So I remember you mentioned the case of the Central Park Five, which is, there are documentaries about it. There's all sorts of things, you know, podcasts. It's just kind of like one of these, I don't know, civil rights tinged cases that always gets paraded around. But recently there was a thread, or there was a bit more, you know, people looking into it, and it's quite a nuanced case if you actually look into it, or, you know, maybe less nuanced. It's, you know, it's literally not at all the way it was presented. And it makes me doubt a lot of the narratives related to, you know, other cases that were similar to this, which, you know, maybe legitimately or not so legitimately, because you really cannot know anymore. That's the scary part.
Yeah. Well, it's not quite Sallow Forum AIDS thread, level of Samizdat, but it's kind of getting there. That particular case, I mean, that happened during the time I was growing up. It was a huge case. For those, again, of your listeners who don't know, there was a jogger in Central Park in New York City in the 1980s. This was kind of during a time when there was actually quite a lot of crime, and it was sort of a dangerous place, not maybe quite the bleakest time for crime, but a much more dangerous place even than it is today in parts. She was attacked. I think part of the thing that's at question is how many people were involved in that attack, but there were five young Black teenagers who were arrested, just brutally, brutally raped to the point that she was left for dead, had no actual memory of the attack. And it was sort of horrific, as it sounds like. Obviously, I don't need to say much more about it than that. And it became this huge celebrated case just because it was in the media capital. The woman had been a professional woman. I think she worked in investment banking. And so I think a lot of kind of the media sort of saw themselves in her to a degree. It fed into a lot of narratives. Donald Trump, quite importantly, really sort of championed. So these five young Black teenagers were arrested. Donald Trump took out a full page in the, it was a time New York real estate developer, kind of really championing this case. And the teenagers were convicted. And then a number of years later, through a variety of things and DNA evidence, if you believe the revisionist history, they were acquitted of the rape. And it was really this other person who did it. But without kind of getting into all of the gory details, I would say that these teenagers, the then teenagers, were awarded tens of millions of dollars collectively. One of them is now on the New York City Council. But again, without getting too deep into the weeds, I think it's fair to say that the whole Netflix documentary and everything that exonerated them, frankly, the evidence that they were at least involved in some very significant way, along with the person who they subsequently arrested for the crime, was to me and many others who looked at the case, including the victim and the original prosecutors and everything, really quite convincing. And so the fact that this has kind of been used, as many, many other cases, as Trayvon Martin, Michael Brown, you kind of name some of these notorious race-based cases, the public narrative is very much at odds with the kind of revisionist narrative that we're being given of these sort of innocent doves who were railroaded by the system.
Yeah. And it's interesting to contrast that with, people who are ostensibly white who perform, very kind of weirdly specific types, like mass shootings and things like that. And school shootings, obviously this is pretty much the caliber of the white shooter, but it's the interpretation of the media of what that means, of white rage and, things like that. It's always very race coded for white people. And a little bit, I mean, this association is always tried to be, played down when it comes to, other ethnicities.
Yeah. Well, it's almost shocking. I mean, I think one of the things in the crime chapter, and it is, of course, by its nature, just more salacious than some of these other chapters, is it's the narrative on crime is so completely reversed from the reality. And I don't mean the narrative that is in our world. I think our world maybe suffers at times from a little bit too much of the reverse narrative.
True.
But the kind of general normie public narrative on crime is so completely at odds, so completely reversed from the reality of like who commits crimes, who are the victims, who are doing the most hate crimes, that it's almost so staggering that it's like you're looking at it, and even though you're staring it at the face, you don't believe it because you're like, well, but we're a rational society in some way. Why are we saying these things that are the complete opposite of the truth? And so it's almost an emperor's new clothes type thing, where people are reluctant to say, no, the emperor is naked. And so we develop, Tom Wolfe really brilliantly, the late satirist, kind of brilliantly satirized this in his 1980s book, The Bonfire of the Vanities, when he talks about these district attorneys going on the hunt, and I mentioned this, of course, in the book, for the great white defendant. They're tired of putting, as he puts it in the book, Blacks and Latins, was the terminology back then, in prison. And so what you want is this juicy white criminal that you can kind of put on the front page of the paper and dispel certain racial narratives they want to dispel. And all that is great. That's what they're sort of looking for. And so they're like Captain Ahab, like searching after the great white defendant, and often not finding them. And you even see this again, and I talk about this in the book. If you look at Law and Order, which is the longest running, but just about the longest running scripted TV show, I think, in the history of America, certainly the longest running crime show. And people have done perpetrator and victim breakdowns in Law and Order versus like the reality. And of course, they're just 180 degrees different. So I think we just have a lot of that going on.
Exactly. And I'm glad you mentioned the possibility of overdosing on red pills. I think that's, you know, the space, you know, the general red pilled space. And this, by this, I'm calling into, you know, question the whole dissident right tends, and especially at this point of maturity, to overdose a little bit on red pills. But I do understand that it's a normal reaction. Like you said, you know, this is very jarring. Difference between reality and what is presented as reality is quite jarring. And then, you know, it's almost inevitable to internalize some sense of maliciousness. Okay, this is not just a cover-up. These are lies. This is like, you know, maliciously provided lies. But at the same time, you know, the core conceit of the flavor of liberalism that exists in the West now is this egalitarian idea, and to prop it up, it makes sense that people, you know, try to, you know, there are incentives for everyone involved in the system to try to minimize this part, and then, you know, maybe as a bit of a remnant of a hollowed out Christianity, try to, you know, kind of become kind of a sacrificial type of species. You know, all, you know, it's don't worry, it's the white people, it's all good, and that kind of feels like it keeps the lid on things. But I think the lid is starting to boil a little bit, and people are not, you know, obviously not keen on participating in this system for too long, especially if they have the actual information, which your book adds to.
Well, I think you're exactly right. And I think you've also kind of outlined implicitly the two dangers. Danger number one is that we keep a lid on reality and create this false reality. And what that leads to is a pressurization at which the right starts overdosing on red pills. And neither of them are guilty. I mean, neither of them are good positions for us to be in. Because what happens, it just creates an explosive situation. And a little bit of what the political scientist, and again, something I mentioned in my book, Timur Kuran at Duke University calls a preference cascade, right? And preference cascade is a neutral concept, but it's sort of the notion that people have different private preferences than they're expressing publicly. And all of a sudden, certain things change in the scenario where suddenly the people who have these different private preferences feel like it's okay to express them publicly. And you get this preference cascade where suddenly a very different set of public values are being offered. Now, that's neutral. But the problem is when you have that type of pendulum swinging in society as opposed to a slow buildup toward something that's a little more true, I think that's very risky. So in many ways, I mean, I don't want to countersignal with this book because it's in many ways kind of a radical book. But in some ways, it's also kind of, I'm trying to de-radicalize. I'm trying to say, hey, you know, we don't want to take the 50,000 red pills here. Let's just see these red pills in front of us, take them in appropriate quantities, and force the left to have a very real conversation about what's going on, to push back in appropriate ways against kind of the anti-white regime that does exist throughout the West, but not to kind of take it where we just continue to bottle this up and then it explodes in some sort of violence on either side, which is the worst possible scenario. I mean, there's a lot of, you go in the further reaches of the right or the left, there's a lot of civil war LARPing from people who I suspect most of them have not really been in civil conflict. And you and your post-communist Romania, right? Like you have a little, sometimes people end up like Ceausescu, right? And, you know, maybe that was maybe that was ultimately a good solution for Romania, but it was certainly a very tense time as that transition ended. And I would suggest that perhaps rather than a Romanian revolution on these issues, a Czech velvet revolution with Václav Havel would be a much nicer place, a nonviolent revolution for the West to be in on these issues. But we do need a revolution in thought. We cannot go on denying reality in the way that we've done. It is too dangerous. And that was why I wrote the book.
Exactly. And another area where I think denying reality is most salient and most heavy is the question of immigration. Obviously this is an important chapter in your book. It's, you know, probably maybe the core question on the right, and I guess on the left as well, because it is, you know, the question of our time.
Yeah.
So how do you see the question of the unprotected class through the lens of immigration?
Yeah, well, I think there's a few things. And this was, I think, one of the longest chapters because it's an area that I've just done a lot of. Not every one of these areas would I claim in any way to be an expert in. And in fact, in some of them, I felt sufficiently non-expert that I showed it to specific subject matter experts and said, hey, make sure, as the Brits would say, there are no howlers in here, you know, that I'm kind of on target. But immigration's one where I've just done a lot of independent writing and feel like I have a pretty good handle on this issue in and of itself. But I think at a certain level, it's just a basic question, which is, do whites of European descent have a right to not be replaced in their own countries? You know, the countries that they grew up in, set the culture of, do they have any valid kind of perspective in that way that matters? Or do we really have to just kind of be in a take-all-comers perspective of what that should look like? And I think it really does get to the foundation of what is a nation, which is something we're acting throughout the West. Are we just creedal? In other words, is it just a set of beliefs? Or are there a particular people that are the kind of foundational group of the nation, even if you kind of have ongoing ethnogenesis? Do those people have a right ultimately to not be replaced by other people? Does the volume matter? Does the source matter? All these kind of things come into play. And the left has been really eager over many years, for those of us who've been working on this issue for quite a while, to immediately kind of discredit anybody who wants to sort of raise these more fundamental questions about what immigration is about and whose purposes it should serve. Hint from my perspective, not just global capitalism or growing the economy, not that those are growing the economy is unimportant. And I think what's been interesting is the volume of immigration has become so high throughout the West just in recent years. And obviously, Biden has been a particularly egregious sort of violator of norms in this respect. But obviously in Europe, although maybe not yet in your part of Europe, this is also a really huge issue. But I think actually one interesting thing that you're beginning to see is almost this multi-ethnic backlash against our immigration policy. And I think there's sort of two things happening is that you have, one, increasing numbers of minority groups, perhaps themselves descendants of recent immigrants, who appropriately and positively kind of feel very American at this point. And they're sort of looking at these people, even if they might in some cases be co-ethnics, and being like, well, that's not us. You know, that's not American. And so you begin to see things like the phenomenon of South Texas, which is virtually an entirely Hispanic area and has a lot of immigration hawks against people coming over the southern border and disrupting their communities. And so I think the left's ability to control this conversation and simply make it about, oh, well, if you don't believe this, you're a white nationalist or you're racist. They're losing that a little bit. And as they often do when they're losing things, they panic and double down because they're worried about what's going to happen when they get crushed. And I think they ultimately will. But the problem is we've transformed our society in pretty fundamental ways without really ever having any consent of the governed. And if you go back and I talk a little bit or more than a little bit in the book about the origins of the dramatic change we had in immigration law in the United States with the Hart-Celler Bill in 1965, if anybody who was voting on that bill in 1965 kind of could foresee America in 2024 would not have, it would have gotten like five yay votes, right? Everything we were promised, if you go back and read the text of those debates, was this is not going to fundamentally transform America demographically. Well, that's exactly what happened. And what's interesting is a lot of people think, oh, the left calling people racist and kind of doing these sorts of racial guilt trips, it's a much newer phenomenon. What I document through a little bit of the firsthand research I did in this book is that as early as, and maybe even before then, but one time I found, in 1968, just 3 years later, in the New York Times, people are looking at the Hartzell immigration bill going like, whoa, this is actually a much more radical change than we thought we were signing up for. And then it says, Congressmen realize this is basically, I'm paraphrasing, but I said, Congress realized this is a problem, but they don't want to fix it because they don't want to look like racists. So that showed the moral power, the moral imperialism that the left had on these sorts of debates, even almost 60 years ago, right? That type of language and category could be used to describe people not wanting to be ethnically replaced. And that had the sort of moral valence that it would be effective in stopping debate.
Yes. I think my worry about the whole question of immigration is, it's track record. You see this in the U.S. as well, maybe a little bit less. I feel like democracy, whatever you think about it as a system of government, is still quite most potent, I think, in the U.S. Because if you look at situations like, Giorgia Meloni in Italy, absolute dumpster fire in terms of immigration, even though this woman is literally picked from the ranks of the far right. She's been involved in far right politics for a very long time. Then you have, the complete and utter dominance for the last, 10 years of Tory politics in the UK, booming immigration numbers. It feels like there is a countercurrent, either, economics, probably mostly, the culture of anti-racism, all of this stuff kind of moving together, making it, almost impossible to actually, have any sort of restrictions. I think Donald Trump was closest to being able to put, even he had a hard time. And that was kind of the red pill moment for a lot of people that, if this guy who's, completely an outsider is having an insanely hard time doing anything, like how possible is it to actually, stem the tide, turn the tide, do anything?
Yeah, I mean, very good question. And I think you're right to look at that. I think people are right to look at the Trump scenario. And I knew Trump's immigration guys very well. In fact, I nearly went to work for on immigration in the Trump administration, and for various personal circumstances ended up not doing that. But those guys were not, for all of Trump's occasionally bombastic rhetoric, or more than occasionally, they were not clueless about what they were doing. I mean, guys like Stephen Miller in particular really knew where the dead bodies were buried, metaphorically speaking. But the system so much, the power structures so much did not want to stop low-skilled immigration that it just, there was a tremendous force back against whatever they did, and elites and elite opinion that controlled the judges to a degree, similar things. And so you had the specter of sort of Obama doing clearly illegal executive orders. And then when Trump would try to repeal those executive orders on immigration, he would be stopped from doing so by a judge. So, I mean, just ridiculous sorts of double standards. And a really, refusal to deal with these type of issues in a really serious way, a refusal to deal with the consequences of immigration in a serious way. And again, this has deep roots. One of the things very interesting, again, talk about in my book, the phrase diversity is our strength, which gets thrown around a lot, actually has its origins, as best anybody has been able to determine, in something Dan Quayle told the Japanese, Dan Quayle being the kind of famously not particularly bright vice president of the United States under H.W. Bush in 1991, in the wake of the L.A. riots, which might have been the exact time that you might not have been saying diversity is our strength. And I quite overtly think, and I want to say this carefully so that I'm not misconstrued, and I talk about this in the book again, diversity, all things being equal, is a weakness, okay, just for society, especially in a democracy. I think you were about to touch on that almost in some of your remarks, and that when you have all of these different groups, and to some extent, a lot of democratic politics becomes zero-sum politics, and there's not a lot of overlap in those groups in terms of background. You know, there's not a shared religion. There's not a shared culture. There's not a feeling of a shared history. Even if it's what Benedict Anderson would call an imagined community, it's still a community. When you don't have that, this is a recipe historically for disasters. It's a recipe for ethnic cleansing. It's a recipe. And this is not in any way making this statement kind of privileging white people per se, or saying that like non-white people are not good Americans or can't be. It's to say in any society, diversity, all things being equal, is not a good thing in my view, or at least large amounts of diversity. And to say that is to be a real heretic, at least in the recent past. Again, I think there's a little more space now where we could discuss these a little bit like more like adults. But to say that is a, like a heresy against the American creed almost. But it didn't always that way. If you go back to earlier America, and I talk about this again in the book, that we did have a much more sense that at least it was good to be unified. And in fact, there were times, I kind of dissect the Nation of Immigrants and that phrase, which was originally basically a Democratic campaign phrase from the Kennedy administration, the ideology. I show how we were not always a nation of immigrants at all. And even if you were to take the most famous book probably ever written about American politics, Democracy America in America by Alexis de Tocqueville, written in the 1830s, does not mention immigration at all. Okay. And it's not because there were no immigrants, but it was a very, very low percentage. And those that were there were overwhelmingly from really Britain, but to the extent that they weren't from Britain, they were from Northwest Europe. So the diversity was much, much less. The uniformity was much, much higher. We are closer in that world that he's describing, this much more uniform world. We are closer in time to de Tocqueville than de Tocqueville was to the original British settlement in the colonies. So there was a whole period of time where, really up to almost the 1890s, where essentially the overwhelming majority of immigration to the United States, not all by any stretch, but the overwhelming majority was from really first from Britain and then from Northwestern Europe. And it was only later, and this is when we began to get our modern immigration politics, that we even began to have large amounts of immigration from other parts of Europe, let alone large amounts of non-European immigration. And so there's this sort of Nation of Immigrants ideology that's sort of sold to lots of kids, including white kids in school. And it really, what I try to show in the book, that a lot of the public ideology around immigration has little resemblance to the actual history of immigration in the United States.
I think what the left is trying to do, and kind of the bigger project, is to unite all of these subpopulations into kind of the woke umbrella, where, you know, the individual is supreme and you have all these like degrees of freedom and, you know, kind of like this social libertarianism that, you know, everyone can let their freak flag fly and we're all in this together and we all love each other. And essentially what unites us is kind of the hatred of the far right, which is kind of the big boogeyman. I think the actual first, you know, significant fly in their ointment has been this whole Israel-Palestine thing, where, you know, you have people who are traditional left-wing cohorts, you know, obviously the Jews, you know, the whole Holocaust issue is kind of the foundational myth of a lot of, you know, so-called wokeness, so-called kind of modern leftism. And then you also have, you know, Palestinians who are, you know, a protected class. They are brown. They are impoverished. They have been under apartheid occupation. They have, you know, and you have these two classes clashing on your turf now in significant numbers, because there now are quite a lot of them on your turf. And this is not the first ethnic conflict that you've imported.
Right.
So I think it is interesting to see how, you know, I think it's quite a subtle and increasing blow to the leftist narrative. Because you really cannot patch these contradictions. It literally can lead to civil war in your streets.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, right. We've imported a huge ethnic conflict. In Europe, in many ways, it's even worse and a little more asymmetric. Here, to the extent there's asymmetry, it kind of goes in the opposite direction, I'd say, that it does in Europe, but you've still got a lot of conflict. And you've got a lot of these, you touched on, I mean, the Jewish community generally being historically a much more progressive political community that is kind of not comfortable with accepting the political reality of today, which is that to the emerging left, they are kind of the ultimate white oppressor. They don't get kind of their special Holocaust get out of jail free card in the minds of the modern left. No, you're just a bunch of rich white guys. And of course, Jews being considered white goes back to the earliest naturalization acts in the U.S., but there were always sort of these gradations. But now you get these groups, and it's not just limited to Jews, but a lot of these groups that are kind of white progressives, let's say generally, that are kind of very uncomfortable having to wear the mantle of, oh, no, you're actually just the oppressor. You don't get to be the victim here. And so I think that's caused tremendous tension within the left community. And I think it's also caused some political movement among kind of influential members of the Jewish community. And I think that ferment is very much playing itself out on the streets. But I think the broader question that you asked totally appropriately is, in a bigger sense, why are we doing anything to import this conflict on our shores? It doesn't serve, in my view, our interest to really be engaged in it at all. And I say that, you know, understanding there's a lot of people who have very passionate views on it one way or another. But I think in many ways, what Trump and America First and everything is about is really focusing, not to say that we can just say, oh, well, that's irrelevant. I mean, clearly it has political and cultural valence and we need to pay certain attention to it because it has effect on America's global interest. But it is to say that our entire focus on this conflict, which is in many ways a result of immigration that's happened here, doesn't really serve the interests of the American people very well, the degree to which it just kind of crowds out other important things that we should be worrying about at home.
Yes, absolutely. To move on to another, I think, important element in your book is the question of technology. I mean, it's probably, after immigration, I think it's probably one of the most salient aspects of this book and generally the culture wars and everything that's going on right now, because it is just so embedded in everything we do. I mean, this is, you know, the channel that we converse on. You know, these people produce, you know, the substrate where I earn my money. There's all sorts of things that are involved in our lives. And if they hate me or people like me, you know, I need to know. It's relevant. So, I wonder what you've discovered in your spelunking in big tech to see how's the unprotected class seen there.
Yeah, well, and it's sort of interesting because I've had a varying career. I actually was sort of an Internet 1.0 guy. Back, I first got on the web in 1993 when you could literally surf the entire web. I mean, it was a few hundred sites. I was one of the first professionals to work in the web / internet industry. And so I eventually kind of in the late 90s migrated away from it. But I've sort of seen this technology grow up from its infancy in terms of its politics. And in fact, I wrote in 1995 a cover story on one of the first ever articles that was probably written on politics on the internet. So I've followed this for quite a while and thought about it for quite a while. I think one of the tragedies of writing a book is there's always like a million pieces of great material that show up right after you've turned in your manuscript. So the Google AI thing would have just been such a delicious thing for me to explore. And I sort of worry that for those people who don't understand the kind of timeline on which book projects work and take, and I turned in my initial, I mean, there were subsequent edits, but I turned in my initial draft for this, I think July 1st of last year. I'll be like, well, why didn't you mention the Google AI thing? But in many ways, it perfectly captured the absurdity of anti-whiteness. I mean, it was almost to a level of parody. Like if I wanted to parody the tech business, I couldn't have done better to show, you know, Black George Washington or funnily, and this also speaks so much to the media, what really did Google in, because before it was just a bunch of conservatives sort of mocking them on Twitter, coming up with these images. It was when we had the Black Nazis, right? When the image of a Black person in a Nazi uniform was generated, suddenly a victim group was being pilloried. So even though the entire thing had its roots completely in anti-whiteness and that they were training this AI to not be artificially intelligent, but to be artificially as stupid as possible. But nobody really cared until a victim group, a designated victim group, was disadvantaged in a small way by this thing that was entirely designed to be prejudicial against whites. So I think seeing what arguably is still the most powerful technology company be so ideologically captured in that way is just indicative of the sorts of problems that are deep-seated within the tech business. And Elon Musk has talked about this a little bit on X, kind of saying, look, he hasn't quite said it in so many words, but he pretty much has. You know, it's basically, unless you fire a bunch of people and really replace them and do like a full culture transplant here, you're not going to fix these problems because they are so deep-seated within the culture of big tech. And if you saw the way that Twitter in the previous regime dealt with anything that touched on what could be considered racist content from the right versus how maybe equivalent content would be happening on the left, where it would sort of be more anti-white, there's no comparison to the levels of censorship that were going on, and the censorship against Trump, sort of similar vein. So really profound issues. I also talk a little bit in my book, and this was, again, a lot of the book is taking secondary literature, as I would say, as an academic. I'm not necessarily coming up with some magical new primary research for everything, but I'm assembling a lot. But one area I did some interesting primary research is to just document Silicon Valley, where I lived for a number of years. You've had white flight from there. That's very easy to just statistically document. And it's kind of a shocking statement because this is supposedly the apotheosis of everything that's great about America. It's the engine of our economic growth, et cetera, et cetera. It's a paradise. The weather is great, et cetera, et cetera. And yet the demographic change there was so overwhelming that whites have fled, like allegedly liberal whites, right? They've just said, I'm out. And not everybody, of course, but you can document going back to the census, the last time Santa Clara County and San Mateo County, kind of the core of Silicon Valley, if you will, the last time they had fewer white people than they had in the 2020 census, you have to go back to like 1950 when the populations were like a quarter or a fifth as big as they are today. And so there's things both within the industry itself and the effects the industry has had on its core communities that have had profound effects on white people. And in some cases, like, you just can't even talk about it, right? These are kind of taboo subjects to even bring up or to suggest that somebody might have a legitimate interest in doing things in a different way.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that you mentioned the perspective of Elon Musk on you know, replacing rather than convincing. I would be very surprised if Elon Musk did not read pretty much everything that Curtis Yarvin has put out. I am convinced that he's a reader because this is essentially the Yarvin playbook, isn't it? It's, you know, you need to bring in your own people. And I think that was essentially the lesson of the Trump administration. They did that partially, but they they should have done it even more radically, to the maximum extent of their abilities. And yeah, that's the whole thing. But I think what is interesting now is that there are more people, you know, this is kind of the, you know, people don't really believe in red pilling the normies, but red pilling, you know, the henchmen, red pilling the middle management is pretty
sure,
good, I think. So that's relevant, you know, whatever the chaff thinks is not that important, but actually having people to populate your companies, your administration, your all of this stuff is quite useful. So, you know, it all slowly trickles down. I mean, I've had this podcast a few years. Obviously, I'm not saying that Elon Musk got his information off of this place. I'm sure he reads the blogs and all this type of stuff. But you know, things have changed quite massively. I mean, even just the fact that Elon bought Twitter. I mean, Twitter really is the place where the narrative is crafted. It's kind of the shore where the rocks are smashed, and then at the end of it, you know, they're nice and rounded, and that's kind of where it happens. So yeah, I think it's definitely a complete, even from the last time we spoke, it's a different world.
Absolutely. And when Elon bought Twitter, I actually got quoted in Fox News and elsewhere because I was tweeting out that the huge significance that I didn't quite use the word historical in some Hegelian sense, but that I thought that, like, as big as people thought this was, it was going to be even bigger. And I've seen nothing that revises my opinion on that. I think it was absolutely huge. The left completely controlled the means of political communication going into the 2016 election, or excuse me, 2020, and that, but they had it in 2016 as well, but they didn't show their power. They hit their power level because they didn't think they were going to need to use it. 2020, they showed their power level, and we saw how much they could completely use technology to censor things like the Hunter Biden laptop story that were indubitably true. Elon opening up that channel for greater discourse was revolutionary. And I think some of this sort of more frank discussion we've had on racial issues just in the last year and a half, 2 years. And by that, I don't mean like the really incendiary stuff, but I just kind of the mainstreaming of responsible but politically incorrect stuff.
FBI official statistics, I think. Yeah. That's enough.
Yeah. I mean, crime statistics being out there and Elon tweeting about them, right? That is a result of this channel being open and why it was so significant. And I know certainly with this book, I mean, there were definitely times when I started writing it almost a couple of years ago where I was like, whoa, you know, I'm kind of out over my skis here. And I think the end product, not because I moved, but because the discourse has moved. I mean, there's still plenty of parts of this that are quite subversive, no pun intended. But the mainstream narrative has actually caught up to some of the things that I've written in this book, where now it's seen as, okay, well, you know, that's a pretty hardcore opinion, but it's not outside the Overton window of something that somebody could express. And I think that that very much is something that has been mediated by the fact that we now have choices in technology.
Yeah, no, I think that's really well put, and kind of brings us back to the question of overdosing on red pills. I think that it's just, you know, the incentives of overdosing are pretty much baked into, you know, these platforms, how people make money on them. You know, the fact that, you know, there's a limited set of revelations that you could offer people, and then you kind of have to push the envelope. And then, you know, there's all sorts of even more like ratcheting conspiracy theories. And, you know, the end point is, you know, being extremely obsessed about the Jews, or extremely, you know, having all sorts of, you know, you need to go all out to keep an audience, or to provide them with the same level of dopamine of, you know, oh my God, this is outrage. But I feel like with this book, you've reached a, you know, a very data-based look at, okay, what is actually going on? And, you know, you let people draw their own conclusions from what you present. So I think that's, you know, the fairest way of actually being fair about this stuff. Because, you know, obviously the problem is people weren't fair up to this point. You know, a lot of this information is either buried or, you know, not spoken of, hush, hush. And now it's out in the open and people are shocked. But, you know, I think you provide an appropriate amount of shock, an appropriate amount of incentives to move the ball forward. So I think we're coming up on time. It is literally the middle of the night where you are. So I'm just going to drop the last question on you, and we can wrap this up, because I want to let people explore the book. There is so much more in the book. And I want to ask you, what is the recommended thinker? I mean, yeah. Second time, you have to have a new one.
I know. And I gave you three, I think, the first time. So I have to go through the memory banks a little bit. I think, again, I'll maybe offer a couple. And one is much more normie and one is a little more edgy. The more normal one would be Pat Buchanan. And just to kind of read some of his old books. And it's not that he was like a brilliant theoretician, although he's a very smart man and his books are very sharp. But I think what's notable about him is he was really a person who, for many years, participated in politics in a very serious mainstream way, who offered a very different political narrative that I think has mapped much closer to reality than a lot of the narratives that were being offered at the time that ended up winning out. And I think in a world in which, in a hypothetical counter world in which we'd had Twitter when Pat Buchanan was running against George Bush in 1992 in the primaries, I think he could have won. And who knows how differently things would have looked with a kind of Trumpian figure, but who was much more versed in Washington, D.C. and politics and was a real intellectual in many ways, had a lot of power. So I think he's good to read, not because he's this amazing thinker, although I think he is a very serious thinker. And I don't necessarily agree with everything that he wrote, but which would be true just about of anybody. But I think everything he wrote was at least serious, and it provides a very different narrative. And I think particularly for your younger listeners, it will show them that there were actually people in very mainstream politics. He was Reagan's press secretary. Then he was a serious presidential candidate who were talking about these issues of race and identity, et cetera, in very different ways, even going back to the 80s and 90s. And that's been sort of shunted under the rug. The other guy I'd recommend, and just because I just read a book by him recently, it was quite interesting, is Renaud Camus. I'm sorry if I'm butchering his name. He is the French writer who coined the term the Great Replacement. And kind of to the extent that even dissident writers know about him in the U.S., that's kind of all they know about him. And honestly, I didn't know that much more about him before I picked up this book, which was the first real translation of his work into English of significance. And what it actually showed, and I knew he'd sort of, he was an interesting guy because he's sort of associated with the far right, but originally he was this kind of promiscuous gay leftist dissident author, and he was sort of known for that before he became known for the Great Replacement. So he was a respected, and is even to this day, despite kind of being penalized in various ways, but he is a respected intellectual figure in the intellectual life of France, where sometimes I think discourse can be a little bit freer than it is here. But what I really got from reading this book is he was really exploring a much deeper set of issues than just kind of the Great Replacement, or the Great Replacement goes beyond just the sort of trivial demography. And having written this book that's largely about democracy, I'm not trivializing demography, but that there's a much deeper set of critical questions about society that go from everything to the environment, to history and culture, that he really explores in a deep and very thoughtful way. And I think he's worth reading for that reason, because he's this guy who's sort of become very known in the U.S. And sort of notorious for this one phrase, but there's a lot more to him, and there was a lot of rich kind of meat on those bones. And in fact, I was talking with a good friend of mine who's a Moroccan woman, interestingly enough, but who spent a lot of time in France and went to the one at the Grand Ecole there. And she was praising him as a French language stylist, sort of par excellence, and just sort of saying, you know, he's a really extraordinary writer, just in terms of his style and the sort of meter that he uses.
What does she think about his politics?
she's sort of unusual in that she actually kind of likes his politics too, but I mean, you know, obviously I think she has some mixed feelings about it, given that, but he's not, I mean, again, he's sort of noted for this thing, but he's not, it's not that he's spending all his time just lashing out against North Africans. He's asking very sensible questions about the speed and rate of demographic change and what it means to be French. And so that is a broader Western question. It's a question that the French, which is definitely a particular people with a particular ethnicity, particular history, historically, even though there was always an amalgamation from other parts of Europe at various times, that's a different question than how we would answer it in the US, because we've always been a little bit more of an amalgam of even more different groups. But it's still relevant. And it's interesting because I think the entire West is asking ourselves this question, and we're answering it in different ways. And I think it's important that we're allowed to ask it. And in fact, I kind of semi-close with the notion that one of the interesting things about this book, and we kind of touched at the beginning about some of the controversy of even saying anti-white in the title, is for my friends, when I originally said I'm going to write this book, they said, yeah, Jeremy, that's great, but you should have, like, Candace Owens should write this book. And I actually, yeah, you're shaking your head. But there was a feeling like ultimately that like as a white person, I'm not really the person who should write this book. And I'm like, no. Actually, it's because I'm white exactly. And I should have the right to write this book. It's really important to the extent that white people are just letting like feel like we can only be legitimized when a minority makes our same point is to automatically admit defeat from the beginning. And so while I welcome allies in what I view as just a quest for racial justice from every community, I felt that it was really important to speak on our own behalf and to not apologize for speaking on our own behalf. And that's what I really tried to do in the book.
Yeah. And I think you managed that. And what I want to, you know, emphasize here is that it is a cold look. You know, it's not, you know, like I said, it's not a screed. It's very much a detailed look at a situation that, you know, has been unfolding for decades, is important, needs to spawn conversations, needs to trickle into politics, and needs to be looked at with the attention, care, and and just gravitas that it deserves for the, you know, yes, for the interests of the, you know, indigenous populations of Europe and in a way America, less so America, but, you know, of Europe, let's say, sure, in their country. So, and, you know, and they have rights and they have, you know, it's absolutely essential. And, right. You know, it's okay to be white. I'm sorry. Right. And it's, I'm sorry to say that.
They have rights and they have legitimate interests that can be balanced with the interests of other groups.
Exactly.
In society, and there's nothing wrong with that. And so that's sort of, again, that's why I wrote the book.
Absolutely. So, yeah, I think people should just stop cringing at the word white. It's fine. You know, it's good. And this is a very fine contribution to that upcoming legacy of reestablishing normality.
And for folks who want to kind of read more about it, first of all, just to repeat, the book is called The Unprotected Class, How Anti-Racism is Tearing America Apart. You can buy it at Amazon or your favorite story won't be out till April 23rd. I'm not sure exactly when this podcast will end up dropping, but you can pre-order it now. You can also follow me on Twitter at RealJeremyCarl or on my new Substack, which is jeremycarl.substack.com. It's called The Course of Empire, and I sort of explore all these issues there. Welcome subscribers of all types. Welcome people, once the book is out, to give me feedback on what they liked, what they didn't like, what they thought I did well, and what they thought I would have done differently, because I expect I'll be doing some follow-up efforts in this same vein at some point.
Excellent. Yeah. Thank you so much, Jeremy.
It's always a pleasure, Alex.